All right, another episode of Tools, Talents, and Techniques. And today I'm joined by Mr. Tyrone Smith. Ty, welcome to the show.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate the offer, Dustin. Looking forward to the conversation.
Well, this is going to be a lot of fun. We have a lot of information to cover, a lot of fun things to cover. But before we jump into your origin story and everything about your development as, you know, professional, as a human being, could you briefly just introduce yourself and say a little bit about what you do?
Hi, everybody. My name is Ty Smith. I live in Baltimore. Actually, I live in Bowie, Maryland, which is about halfway between Baltimore and D.C. I spent the last 20 years supporting the intelligence community. I didn't do anything spooky. All I did was to help ask a bunch of questions, which is going to be a part and parcel of what we talk about today. But I spent time helping them understand what job they're trying to do, like their purpose, their mission set. I'm married with two boys, both of them grown kids right now. One's 21, one 19. Both of them STEM-y type of kids. My wife teaches mathematics, so they got that math part from them. They got my curiosity. They got like the curiosity from me. So it would be in STEM, they would call her the engineer and me the physicist. She builds. I ask why we're even building it. So I've been spending a lot of time working with startups over the last 5 years, really thinking about what are they trying to build? Why is it important? I even did it inside of an agency. They call them intrapreneurs. And so working with product teams or idea teams, getting them really squared away on what problem they're solving. So that's what I do.
Well, a couple of things. I love that you called your kids STEM-y. That's a new turn of phrase. I haven't heard that before, but it makes perfect sense. And then, you know, so you said that you didn't do anything spooky, but that's what we'd expect somebody who worked with intelligence agency to say, like, nothing to see here. But
I purposely, and I've worked in that environment for almost 20 years, like 2004 through 2021, purposely didn't do anything. But what it did do, it gave me a really good boost in my income when nice. I got inside the building. But I purposely didn't do anything because it wouldn't allow me to have real hard conversations because I don't care what you're doing, right? That's the what. I'm interested in why you're even doing it. And that has nothing to do with intelligence or analysis. It is like, why are we even in the space that we're in? And so those are the kind of questions that I would ask.
Interesting. Let's talk about the origin story. So where are you from originally? Like, where'd you grow up? What was your upbringing like?
So even though if I had cut all this off and my hair and the beard, I wouldn't look like I'm starting my sixth decade, right? I'm 57. I was born right after the Tet Offensive. So that's how old I am. So for your listeners that understand a little bit of Vietnam story, that's how old I am. But I'm from Pennsylvania. And if you know anything about Pennsylvania, and I know that you do, Dustin, because you're from PA, I
go
would
birds.
Be...
go birds.
There you go. Fly, Eagles, fly. There you go. I'm from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where they have Pennsylvania Dutch. And my joke is I'm the only black Dutchman that you ever meet. I'm not really, but I'm the only black Dutchman that you'll ever meet. I grew up in a small town where on November 1st, school would clear out because everybody goes deer season, buck season. It's opening day of buck season. And school would clear out and everybody goes hunting. But I didn't hunt. I did fish, but I didn't hunt. So the town that I grew up in was very, very small. Everybody that looked like me were my cousins or just outside of being a cousin. 2,500 people, no traffic light, 1 mile long, about a half mile wide, a little over a quarter of a mile wide. And that's where I grew up. Part of my origin story is I'm an athlete. I was a state champion hurdler back in the day and loved to hurdle, been coaching and hurdling in one form or another since I was 15. But when I went to school, I went to a small state school in Pennsylvania where I proceeded to flunk out. And after I flunked out, I was like, what do I do? And so that summer before I actually flunked out, I became a police officer. I was 18 years old. So basically, I look like I look now only 40 years later, nearly 40 years later. Same basic body, face, head, you know, I don't think I was bald at that point, but I did. But I did cut my hair fairly short. And so it was a great way to grow up. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about people. As a matter of fact, I used to tell people that one of the things that I did was kind of stupid. But when I was a police officer, I used to go to domestics by myself. And that's where most cops get hurt. And the reason why I say that is because I learned about my own voice and my authority. I was a quiet kid. You know, I was a track and field, and I was in the theater, and I was, you know, part of the smart group. But I never really felt anywhere particular. But when you're on the street and you're trying to do an investigation or stop a fight or anything like that, you have to find your voice. And so I learned to find my voice back then, and it's carried on since then. After I stopped policing, I started working with kids. I went back to the same school I flunked out of, by the way. Got my degree, farted around for a year, and then I ended up going to Howard University, where I met a gentleman, a mentor who's since passed, who taught me things about organizations and how people behave in organizations. That was literally mind-blowing. And after 30 years, I'm finally in the organization that he introduced me to. I'm a fellow in that organization where we study social systems. 30 years later, I went from working with kids to working with organizations. And what I say about organizations is that they are like very sophisticated, disturbed children, right? And families. When you have kids, when you have disturbed kids and disturbed families, they are all out there. I mean, it's just, you can see it. They don't hide anything. The kids go off, the parents are crazy, blah, blah, blah. But what happens in organizations, they become defended around process. They become defended around language. They become defended around their organizations. They start to do the blame game. Well, if only they would do that, then we could behave. And if only they would do that, we could have a better outcome, or we could, you know, track our innovation, or we could, you know, do better on our P&L. And so I took everything that I learned with the kids, everything I learned with this professor, and, you know, fast forward, including the 20 years I spent supporting the intelligence agency, that's where I am now. I am vastly and incredibly interested in how do we get technologies that my STEM, you know, my STEMIs in the house, a mechanical engineer and a computer scientist, students, both of them students right now, but how do they, people like them, how do they build businesses? How do they create value? And I would say that while it's a, I understand that we have to build businesses, that it's about creating value for people. And that's where the bulk of my focus is. So that's kind of my origin story from when I was a little kid in South Central Pennsylvania all the way up to what I'm doing right now, which is talking to you.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things I'd like to dive into and discuss, because I've noticed, especially doing this podcast, is people will say things in moments in their lives and decisions that they made. And there's usually something there where I'm like, well, I want to hear more about that. One, because you're a smart kid, you come from a nice family, a good family, and then you flunked out of school. Was there something in that moment that, or that you look back on now and say like, oh, this was why I was making those decisions or not making those decisions?
Well, part of the reason, as a state champion hurdler, you know, you just fool yourself. Like, I was good. I mean, I literally said after my junior year, I'm going to win states a year later. And I ended up winning states. Almost lost. I ended up with a hamstring pull, but I was able to finish it out and finish second in the other race, right? So I got a silver and a bronze. I mean, silver and a gold. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go run somewhere. I think that I am very serious that I think that I could have at least made the Olympic trials, right? In one particular event. I was pretty good, right? I knew my stuff, and I was finally coming into my body. But I was young. I was like 17, and I wouldn't turn 18 until the end of November of that year. So I mean, there's a whole bunch of people in their full bodies, and you know, they had an entire year being 18. And there's something to be said. Malcolm Gladwell talks about the difference between a Hall of Fame ice skater and ones that don't. And it literally is, when do they start playing? And the older ones that start playing at the top of the age group are the ones that end up being there, because they understand they have a different relationship with their body. And same thing here. So I ended up going to a state school where I had a coach. God bless him. He was a great recruiter. Didn't know anything about my event. And I ended up getting hurt and despondent. I didn't know what to do. And I was just like, I'm done with this. I just didn't want to do it. And so part of that was that. Now, I could have done anything. I'd gone to the military. But there was also a piece of me that was trying to connect with my dad, which I didn't tell you was he was a 25-year career in state as a state trooper, Pennsylvania State Police. Right? And if you know anything about the Pennsylvania State Police, you know, people could be fighting. All it takes is one state trooper to show up and people stop, right? They just stop moving because they kind of silly, and they just have this gravitas about them. And so I did it to try to connect with him. But the thing that I think is most important that actually got me back into school was I didn't need that anymore. I needed him, but I didn't need the thing to get close to him. And I knew I was right. Because, you know, he's a state trooper, Air Force, during the Vietnam era, and he was part of, he's 81, he's 82 now, so he's born in 1942, so he had a very different relationship of how he grew up. And I, you do because I say, and you don't question it. He was like, ah, Greg, ah, ah. At one point I said, that's not me. But you can run back. But that's not my choices. My choices are different. And it was when that happened that he softened and actually gravitated to having a relationship where he would come and he would kiss me on my forehead. That man could hardly hug me, right? He would get angry and walk away. But now he was able to hug me. And so it created a different relationship. And now that he's 80 and, you know, he's doing that, you know, the joke goes, what has two legs? What has four legs, two legs, and three legs? Man. And as you get older. And so now he's in the three-leg stage, which is the end of life stage. And having to make those, helping him make those choices. And I think that a lot of what you're speaking to in terms of choice making and how I've come about my choices have come with me having the capacity to have honest conversations with myself about what's important and what's not important, what is vital to and life-giving to me, and what is, you know, a drag, right? There's a, I don't know if you know the guys, the book Freakonomics, but there's Dubner is one of the guys' name. The other one's an economist. The other one writes about economists. And I can't remember, one of them's Dubner, but when they talk, they have one chapter in one of their books, I think it was the Super Freakonomics book, where they talk about the upside of quitting, right? We live in a society that says if you quit, you lose. But there's an economic cost to continuing. It's knowing when to stop, right? That gives you power. That gives you the capacity to provide and create value for yourself. As a Black man, we're taught that you can't quit. You have to be twice as good to do that. But there's also a toll that comes with that. There's an emotional and social toll that comes with twice as good. Can I show up and be me? Can I show up in all of my authorized voice and space and have the capacity to feel fully okay? It's hard, right? And then so that's what I try to do with people that I work with. It's like, how do you, Black, white, it doesn't matter. How do you find your authentic voice? Women, children, college students, I say children, not to those that are my age and my kids. Like, how do you find your authentic voice? How do you find the space where you can hold that?
You know, and I think that's a very poignant topic, and especially when you talk about like quitting specifically. And sometimes I found letting go is not the same thing as quitting, right?
Bingo.
Like there's a weight to quitting, and you're placing judgment on it. And bad. Sometimes letting go, you know, if you're, and one of the expressions, it's not an expression, but it's, you're getting rope burn and it's burning you and you're holding on, like, let go. You know, sometimes
exactly.
Those things are not helping you. And the best thing that you can do for yourself and those around you is to let go. And that's not necessarily quitting.
And I think the idea of letting go in terms of knowing what you and I have been talking about prior to the podcast and in our developing and emerging relationship is that there's an idea of letting go in the startup world is I don't have enough data to secure that what I'm doing is of any use to anybody. And so I just need to pivot away from it or just kill the idea. But I think there's also, and so that's a little easier than what I'm about to say, unless you trap yourself in that my job or my thing is me, is when do I let go of stuff that's not good for me? People, ideas, culture, notions of success, notions of value. How do I let those go so I can find new space? In the economics literature, they call something, there's something called creative destruction. And it's usually associated with economics. But the idea is that some things have to go so you can grow new things. Duh, right? How do I creatively destroy things that are not good for me anymore or are in my way of being successful? And if I can figure that out, now I'm freed up to create things that I had no space or imagination to build. I had an opportunity to do a keynote at NASA last year in their innovation award ceremony for their scientists. And so my keynote, all of 7 minutes, was based in this idea of the audacity of imagination, right? And the story that I told is that I am the grandson of two people from Seneca, South Carolina, who were sharecroppers, right? My grandmother said, if you're going to be a garbage man, be the best garbage man, well, just do it. Just be brilliant at it. These are the same people. She said, if you don't, you can be poor, but you don't have to live poor. They used to take straw brooms and sweep the dirt front yard. Those same people came north in 1942 with my dad. And I remember as their grandson there, 19, I must have been 7 years old, maybe, laying on their floor, watching the Apollo moonshots. Think about the Apollo moonshots. 60 years earlier, they're just figuring out how to fly a plane. 70 years earlier, they're figuring out how to fly the plane. They were able to take a rocket and shove it to the moon, right? The audacity of the imagination, not creativity. Creativity is the outcropping of being able to imagine something. I can put it together. But how do we have the audacity to imagine a different way of being? Most of us get stuck in, oh, I'm creative, or most of us get stuck in, I don't know what else to do, so I'll just continue to do what I'm doing. But I believe that the same imagination that requires, that is required to launch a rocket, that has this robot sitting on the top of it to go, how far is Mars? 100 million miles away. As this thing is rolling around, this thing is coming at 18,000 miles an hour to press a button to release these parachutes that slows down and you bounce it around and it lands and it works. The audacity associated with that. But yet we behave as if we can't get out of our own ways because we don't have the imagination to do that. And I think imagination is so under...
Well, you know, a couple of these things, I want to go back to what you said about, you know, letting go and whether it's ideas or things or limitations, and that'll bleed into what we're talking about is imagination, but also the awareness to know when you're sometimes you're holding on to things. Actually, oftentimes you're holding on to things just out of pattern and, you know, habit and, you know, you're not even aware that you're holding on to something and you're limiting your thought process, your beliefs. So even coming to the realization that maybe this thing that I'm doing that I'm not even aware that I'm doing is not only not helping me, but it's holding me back in many ways. And so I think that's a really important thing about, you know, being around people that have your best interest at hand and on mind, about reading, about journaling. And there's a lot there.
Yeah. What I told you about this gentleman I met at Howard University, my professor, late professor, he was instrumental in helping me understand. I took this class with him called Group Dynamics, and he was instrumental in helping me understand patterns of behavior that people get locked in groups, that in some ways they have no idea that they're getting locked into, to your point. And the first time that he did this thing called a social vortex where people get sucked into roles. And I literally was like, I know what that is. I see that every day at the unit that I work on with these kids. And it was those experiences that helped me unlock some of these kids, right? Like to say, you know, you don't have to feed into that. Because it feels really familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Can I help you unpack that? That would be cool. So let's get to work, right? Yeah. That sometimes, I think this is the power of coaching, mentoring, whatever it is to have somebody that has your best interest in mind that looks at you and says, take a look. This is what's going on. Excuse me. The data would suggest that this is how you're showing up. The data would suggest this is how people are seeing you. So no matter how you feel about yourself, which is cool, and I allow you to feel, you feel however you want, but is that getting you whatever you are looking for? Mm. How you're showing up in the world, is that getting you what you're really looking for? And sometimes people's like, yeah, I'm like, cool. If that works for you, go for it. But if it doesn't, how do we flip that script, right? How do we find a way to help you get to where you want, knowing this is where you're coming from?
I don't want to go beyond. I want to talk about some of the innovation and the ideas and things, but I think it's really important because you touched on a couple of things. One, you've mentioned a few mentors that you've had in your life, and you've used the word mentorship. You mentioned the person at school. You mentioned your father and that relationship. Just how important have the mentors been in your life?
I have two screens. And whenever I do these kind of conversations, I'm not the focus. I jump on and I go and I Google and it's like, okay, I want to make sure I got the word right. So I'll Google it up. It's interesting the difference between a mentor and a coach, right? The mentor tells you, hey, you didn't do this right. The coach says, hey, by the way, this is the plan and this is how you're behaving. So if you want to continue down, cool, do whatever you got to do. But that ain't getting us where we want to go. My mentors have actually coached me into better behaviors. And I had one coach and one experience of a coach versus a mentor. And I think it's important to say this. When I was in high school, I went to a school that was very white. And I remember having an experience about how I carried myself in school. And I thought I was trying to do stuff and I wanted to hang out with white kids, you know, to figure it out, but it wasn't culturally consistent and it felt kind of funny. But I had a teacher who basically told me that black people could be scientists. I was like, but here's my uncle's card. He's a physicist for the Department of Energy. He's like, No, seriously. He is a physicist with the Department of Energy doing fusion projects, nuclear scientist. And I was hurt. I was devastated. I mean, like, whoa, this dude, seriously? This is my one of my heroes, one of my mentors. He's a hero, right? A science hero. And I went to track practice. I was in 10th grade. I was crying. I was devastated. And my coach, he has since changed his last name, but his name was Milovanovich. But we called him Milo. Coach Milo came up to me and he said, what's wrong with you? He's a coach now, not a mentor. A mentor, give me the prescription. The coach said, what's wrong with you? Dr. Brown said, blah, blah, blah. And he looked at me and said, some people just don't understand. Let's get to work. He showed up. He was there for me. And it made perfect sense to me. He didn't try to tell me, did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? He didn't do that. He coached me through the experience. Some people just don't understand. Let's get back to work. Let's go and win. Let's do, how do you want to show up? Went and kicked some butt, right? I was a freshman I was 10th grade, but as a freshman, I was running on the varsity relay team, right? I didn't know what I was 13 years old, man. Big head, little body, running with these, what looked like grown men to me. But that informed a coaching experience that I had. And I was I've worked with little ones all the way up to Olympic size folks, right? Trying to run the Olympic trials, which I had one who was an Olympic athlete. Olympic level athlete. She said, Coach Ty, you know what I like about you? I said, what's up? Like, you don't know everything. You help us, but you don't know everything. You listen to us, right? Hey, you know you got to do this, but guess what? I ain't got to run. I don't have to go out there and compete. I can help you get there, but I don't have to compete. And I took the lessons from my coach and I said, listen, they were women, young women, 20. At that point, they were 22 to 27 or something like that. I wasn't much older, but they would come on the track and they would be fussing and fighting. Hey, coaching, listen, we're out here to work. We're going to walk the track 400 meters and you can say whatever you want. We just talk. But when we get back here, we're getting to work. And when we got to work, we ran the workout 90 minutes later. I said, you good? She's like, yeah, I'm good. I done figured it out. I done exercised all that bad energy. And while I'm running, I'm talking to myself, whatever they were doing. Like, we're good. Time to move on. Keep it moving. Yes, right? And I think that's what good coaches do. They help you, like, get you. Stop it. Give you a good shake and say, now, what's going on? This is going on. Okay, great. Here's what we can do. Because right now, we got to get back to work.
And, you know, you also mentioned, actually, every time that we've spoken so far, I believe you, I stopped taking notes about which books you recommend because you throw one at me every time. But
sorry.
No, it's good. Hey, these are good. These are good influences to have. People tell you which books to read. So when did that start? Were you a reader from a young age? Has that evolved over time? And do you look at reading as another form of coaching?
An interesting question. So I was that kid that read encyclopedias. I didn't read books. I was an information hound, right? In high school, do you remember Trivial Pursuit? Remember the game? All right, so I was that guy. People wanted to be on my team. Why? Because I have a head full of useless knowledge. Okay, maybe not so useless in Trivial Pursuit. But what it did do, that way that I read, is that I could read a little bit of here and a little bit of here and a little bit here and a little bit here and then synthesize drop something out that felt thoughtful, if not original. I had to think about how I wanted to say that. Because one of the things that I don't like is when people just parrot. Like, what did you think? What's your idea? Right? But we know that there's no idea, new idea under the sun. There are ideas that come out that have been, that are glommed on like Lego bricks to new ideas that maybe will generate some new way of thinking about an idea. And so I did do my, I was in graduate school. I had to do my reading in graduate school. But I read as, check this out, starting in undergrad, I started as a chemistry major. And that sucked because I wanted to do the really cool stuff, but you had to do the basic stuff first to get to the cool machine kind of stuff. I could, you know, I was anticipating that. The part that I didn't like, is that nobody said anything when I was in a lab, like 8 hours a week, and I didn't get breakfast or lunch during that time, and nobody spoke. And that drove me nuts. I wonder why. Maybe because I was an extrovert?
I don't know.
But but what I did do, and after I flunked out and then came back, I became an act, and I had no idea what I was saying, except that it felt right, even back in the 1980s, that I was an academic entrepreneur. I was always looking for, so where else is the knowledge? Where else can I contribute in a way that I just wouldn't read a book and then, you know, cite my resources, but I could really start to think about and engage with people differently. And so now I read, if I could turn my camera on, you see, I just got surrounded by books. Have I read them? Not necessarily. Did I read Adam? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But then I go and I take, and so I'll read a title. I'm looking at a book right now, Playing to Win. I know a little bit about it. It's a strategy framework. Okay, how do I take Play to Win and help people understand what strategy really is without boring them with all the stuff and me being bored by somebody telling a story about it? Do I know enough that I can actually be conversant? I had had a conversation today that tells me, yeah, I didn't do too bad. Kind of understand what I'm talking about. Am I expert at it? Nah. But I think that there is an interesting choice point between being an expert and having expertise. Because when you have expertise, you are part of a, and there's some writing about this out there, that the difference between an expert is the singular point of knowledge, but expertise is the collaboration that you bring to a field of information, a field of knowledge. I don't consider myself an expert in anything, but I can contribute to the expertise in the room.
I like that. I like that a lot. And also, there's a, you know, novel Ravikant. And I apologize if I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly, but there's a guy, and he was on a podcast, and he said something about his relationship with books that completely, for me, was a paradigm shift, because I always looked at reading as a duty, and you needed to get through it, and you know there's a test at the end of it. But when he mentioned, he's like my relationship with books is, if I'm interested, I'll pick it up, I'll start reading it, if I like it, I'll keep reading it. If I don't, I'll put it down. And then maybe I pick it up late. And I was like, man, I have never, and this was, I want to say when he first said this, might have been 2015. And it completely changed my relationship with books. And now, you know, I'll read a little bit. And then if I don't like a chapter, then I'll skip to the next chapter. And if I don't like that chapter, then I'll put it down. I'll pick it up later. And so I feel like that has been, I would say, just a paradigm shift, but it's made me reevaluate my relationship with a lot of things that I thought I don't like this, or I do like this. Like, well, what is it I like about? And just doing that further examination of those things, and it just changed a lot of things in my life. It's an amazing thing.
So I'm going to blow your mind a little bit more. I know that you are a fan of ChatGPT, right?
I am.
Based on some of the things that we've done. Just in the quick, short time that I've known you. How about this? That reading is the prompt engine for your mind.
Okay. Let me digest this a little bit.
So when you read, and particularly if you read pieces and pieces and pieces, that what you're doing is creating a prompt engine. You're creating a way to construct ideas that aren't linear, but are scattered and put together. Because the reason why the prompt engines work in the ChatGPT, in the chat environment, it's a math equation, like simply. I had to explain it to my dad. It's like it's a math equation. You put a word, and the probability of the ones going in either side either get higher or lower depending on what the word is associated with that word. And so you just go that way, right? It's a math equation. So if you're reading, you have a pile of 25 books and you've read a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of other, a little bit of other. And as you start thinking about it, you're building an algorithm about how to think about an idea, right? And so you're basically prompting your brain to come up with a response, because now I have bits of information instead of reading a book completely through. And now I have only this text, right? In the prompt world, if I have only this and I don't inform it in any other way, what do you end up with? A hallucination, because it starts to make up stuff that's not there. But the more information that you can, the more sophisticated that you can bring your nuanced and sophisticated that you can create in a prompt in ChatGPT, the less hallucinations you get, because it's more critical. In other words, what you end up with is in reading is the ability to be critical, to be creative, to be imaginative in the way that you deal with information. Because the more you read, asks Bill Gates, the more that you can start to make connections between ideas. You have a bunch of different authors, you're prompting your brain to make these connections. All of a sudden you go, whoa.
Yeah.
Now you can just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. Right. And so reading is the same, I think, my hypothesis is the same as the prompt function for ChatGPT. It has a bunch of information, but it doesn't have a way to make the connections. Right. Mm. And when we read, we're making connections in our brains. Like, I never thought about that. To your point, I never thought reading was just a task. It wasn't an opportunity to explore.
Yeah.
Is what I heard you say.
I like that. Yeah. I want to go back to your professional journey and your life journey. And so as you're working with the youth and you're coaching, and then you start working, like, what's the next step in your career journey look like? Like, when do you start to really feel like, oh, this is the path that I want to take for the next stage?
There's an assumption there, isn't it?
Yeah, there sure is. Yeah, there sure is. Well, there's always a step, and the path is not always straight, but it's up there. There is a path somewhere.
Right. So while I was in graduate school, I had to eat, right? Because I got there too late for my scholarship, and even the scholarships they had were, I think I had tuition, and then I had to work as I did have tuition paid, and I had to work as a TA to teach classes to help with my, a little bit of money or whatever. So I needed a job, and the job led me to working with these kids. Now, prior to going to graduate school and after I was a police officer, I worked with adjudicated juveniles, and it was cool. And I came to graduate school. I worked with these very disturbed kids and their families. And then I went to a school-based environment. It was a full-time residential program. And then I went to the school-based. My next step, now remember, I'm in graduate school this whole time, just trying to figure it out, understand what's going on. I finished my master's, started working on my PhD, and blah, blah, blah. There's only so many times you'd be called an MF-er, right? Exactly. Like, okay, y'all gonna cuss me out again? How about you stay home? No, Mr. Smith, I'll see you tomorrow. No, it's okay, son. You can stay home. It really is. Because I done messed with you all day long. Say, nah, I'll see you tomorrow, Mr. Smith. All right, peace out. I went from there and I didn't have it in me anymore because it stopped being fun. And maybe that's one of my faults. I'm looking for something that's fun. And fault is whatever it is, right? But anyway, I went from there and I started working with adults. And that's when I learned about the way that adults work is the same way that kids work. And during that time, what I learned in school, working with understanding groups, working with these students, I was able to move into the consulting work, right? Really working with people, doing a lot of facilitation. I've been doing, it's funny when people say, how long have you been doing facilitation? And I had to go back like 19, I think the first time I facilitated something was like 1988, right? I've been facilitating longer than some people have been alive and had been doing it continuously and on and off, even up until now, right? I'm still doing it. But I took it in a way that became professional. It became a professional experience for me. I'm doing curriculum development, building out curricula for, I did one for customer service and I got my clearance and I ended up working in those same cleared spaces, the national security spaces for almost 20 years, where it's really funny, Dustin, that I could say things that would normally get people fired or get them removed from a contract because I feel that because I was saying it with sincerity and curiosity about how to create value, there would be seniors, very senior seniors, that would say, okay, so what do you think, Ty? And I'm like, you asked. Here's what I think. Because I wouldn't just say stuff because it wasn't about expanding the contract. It was literally about helping people. And in some ways, it's hurt me, right? What I am, I am. I can't do anything. And when I say it's hurt me, it's I am okay with working with people. You know, I can do all the planning and all that stuff. But the thing that gives me the most joy is when I'm working with people. And at the end of the day, after literally standing on my feet for, you know, 8, 6, 14 hours, 16, and I'm standing on my feet, just doing that over and over again, doesn't bother me. I could just continue to do it because it's fun.
Yeah.
Fun.
When you mentioned that there were things that that you could say and some people get fired, but it also goes back to the why and the how, for sure, like how you're delivering it, but also why. And that reminds me of something you said earlier about, you know, the root. People know that there's sincerity in why you're doing something. And if you can express that, if you know your voice, again, something that you alluded to earlier, and you can speak to that, then that's powerful. And people respect it. And people see it. People can understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you come in and you work with integrity, right? I think integrity is the word for me, that I may not be right. Never intended to say that I was always going to be right. But you can never besmirch my integrity. You can never say, oh, he was just doing this because I said things that have hurt me. There are times that I've done stuff for free just because I think it's the right thing to do. Now, as I get older, my wife is around, I gotta stop doing things for free for a whole bunch of reasons. But you will never be able to say that I didn't do it with the best of integrity. May not be right, but I did it to my best. And that's important to me.
So in your experience and doing the work and, you know, working with people and building curriculums and doing all these things, has there been any specific types of work that we talk about science, we talk about technology, like anything that jumps out in your path that you're like, this was when I was glowing the most, right? Like this was when I was this type of project. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, three of them. One, there is another strategy framework called Blue Ocean. Blue Ocean basically says it's along the line of the creative destruction stuff. If we're going to create value for customers, what do we need to stop doing that we're currently doing that allow us to do things that they couldn't expect or otherwise we could grow or they couldn't expect? An example of that is the circus. The difference between why Cirque du Soleil was so very successful and continues to be successful, then you have Ringling Brothers, who had been around for 100 years to make $1 billion when Ringling Brothers did it in 25. Why? Because they created differentiation. I brought that to the government and it literally changed the way they thought about how they did business, right? Do we have to do this particular part of the government I was working in? Do we have to do the things the same way that we have, or do we have options? And if we do have options, how do we create a way forward? And it was so fascinating. The guy I was working for said, you know, he was a retired Marine Corps pilot, been around for a while. He was on the finance, which is always the most interesting part. All that science stuff is fine. Finances run the world, right? Because that's where the money is. He's like, I've been around this game for a long time, and this is the first time we actually use a strategy to make decisions. We usually build it and then put it on the shelf and say, so what are we going to do? Because we know how to do this. Versus, no, we've invested a lot of time in this. How do we do that? That's the first one. The second one was completely different. It was a merger, like how to bring an organization with like 2,000 people involved and in the government, an SES is equivalent of a one-star general. Like SES-1 is equivalent of a one-star general. So we had these equivalent of colonels and equivalent of one stars and then, you know, fewer two stars in this organization that my job was to help bring them together. And it worked wonderfully. We tried all kinds of stuff. One thing about, I think one way to be successful is don't be afraid to try. Again, it's about integrity. Did it work? You know, you can say, I don't know if it worked, but I sure gave it the best try I could because I thought it might and I was willing to experiment. But this one actually worked. We were actually able to, at least in the first round, bring together two organizations that heretofore had been like this to actually help them come together like this. to figure out what it would look like. Now, they've iterated a bunch of times since then. That's fine. I don't care. I care because hopefully they're still in business, but I don't care what they did. But the initial conversation was to bring them together from who's going to be in charge all the way down to what products that we're going to, how we're going to combine products, right? My job was to do that. And the final time with the same organization was when we build out using Lean Startup Principles, the idea of Silicon Valley principles to help them build stuff, stuff that people would use. It was fantastic. There was two government people and three contractors. I wrote the first curriculum. The other two guys that came on board, we iterated on the curriculum. We taught it. It was fantastic. We went all over the place. We worked with the people in the Pentagon. We worked with other agencies. We worked with like the FBI, bringing them in to teach them about how to do this in a way that they could create imagination about a product, something that was creating value, that had the value proposition was really solid. And so those are the ones in my past, in my most recent past, that were really exciting. That really made me feel like, wow, I did something.
It's funny when the lean startup and government processes and spending don't seem like, in many minds would go together.
But it's funny
maybe that's what makes it so special.
One of the times the team went, we went to a particular undersecretary in the Pentagon. So you have the secretary, the deputy secretary, and then you have undersecretaries under them, right? And this person had a pretty big responsibility. And they brought the team in to say, teach us about this stuff. We've been hearing about this. And after the team went through it, they were like, well, we can't be innovative. We don't build anything. Like, you write policy? Yeah. Well, shoot, that's a great way to start. You write a policy. You don't do it for everybody. You run an experiment. You run a small scale experiment to see whether or not these couple of word changes resulted in the same thing. And if they did, but you reduced the amount of overhead, time, resources, people, well, heck, now you're onto something, right? That's Lean Startup. That's what and it was so funny because this person wrote back to the director of the agency. His colleague is like, yeah, that team came over. They really helped us out. They helped us think about some things, some really hard stuff.
Are there any other places? And I'm sure this is a very wide question here. Maybe I narrow by asking this. Where do you feel like of all these things that you've learned and you've done, like how does that equate to like what you're excited about now and the things that you're doing? Is there like I have all of this that I can apply to X or like I can apply this to Y? And I mean, having the conversations with you has definitely helped me evolve everything that I'm thinking with ranges, with the golf range finders that I'm working with. So it's been, I know that's very specific use, but is there a broader scope or anything that you're excited about how you're applying this?
Yeah. Just today I was helping to co-facilitating an event where folks are thinking about how to, the acronym is called ALICE, which is, I can't remember, but it's a specific way to think about, can't remember what it stands for, but about underserved communities, basically the working poor. Right. People who have jobs, but they don't have assets, asset limited, income constrained, employed. That's what ALICE stands for. Just remember. Right.
Okay.
So asset limited, income constrained, yet employed. Right. So the working poor. I think that, in fact, I know that you can use these design principles to solve these hard problems the same way that you would do in Lean Startup. That excites me. I was at the NASA Goddard. I live in Maryland. I'm close to NASA Goddard. It's the largest of all the NASA facilities. So if you think about Houston, this one's bigger than Houston. This is the one that actually built the Hubble Space Telescope and some of the other, the Webb Telescope. They built it on this property. Talking to the Office of Strategic Partnerships, and they are excited about, can you help us think about who we should be talking to in terms of underserved populations? Black folks, Hispanic folks, tribal, helping us get contacted with them so we can help them take advantage of all this technology to build, to do wealth creation, right? That takes a different way. You'd be able to take some of the stuff that I've been learning over the last 20 years and building that out to help folks think about, so what would it take for me to, what would it take for me to build this out? Well, let's try some Lean Startup stuff. Don't build the thing. We know they got the technology, but let's build your ideas. Let's solve a problem. I think another way to think about this, all the stuff that excites me, that I've learned is this idea, our podcast, not called What Pays, U-P-A-Y-S, which is what problem are you solving? And the idea is if you can figure out what problem you're solving, you can figure out what pays, you know, tongue in cheek, right? And so learning about what problem you're trying to solve and really trying to build our muscles, my own personal consultant, you know, coach muscles around that, that allow me to go and work at the agency that I was working at and others to help them think about the real problem they're trying to solve and becoming clear about that and who they're solving it for is the thing that excites me. So when I'm here in the community, I'm working with a Dustin and Dustin's like, hey, I got this. I'm like, are you solving this problem or that problem? Dustin goes, that's a good one. I don't know yet. Let me go do some discovery. Go talk to people, right? How to build that out. And so all of these things, customer discovery, hypotheses, experimentation, pivots, and all the rest of that stuff is built on everything that I learned that I do and work with now.
Yeah. And so you mentioned your podcast. So between that, your profile, everything that you want to share, all of that information would be on the show notes. So anybody who's listening or watching, you don't have to rewind it. Just go to the show notes. It'll be linked there. So you can go right to all of that. Before we leave, we got a few more minutes left here. I want to open up this space for you to just talk about what I want. You can talk about whatever the hell you want to talk about, but I really want you to be able to express high level, like what problem are you solving? Like with what you're doing and everything you're doing, like where do you see this all going and your ideal next step in where everything is going? Like how do you see this all unfolding in the next few years?
So it's interesting that you would say that. I had an opportunity to meet the legacy of some of the folks from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And for those that may or may not know about Tulsa, if you know about Tulsa, you know what I mean. If you don't know about Tulsa, here's a bit of a lesson. Tulsa, Oklahoma, this place called Greenwood. It's one of my buddies from there. It's not very big. It's maybe a mile long, half a mile wide, kind of like where I grew up. In 1921, the entire town was burned down based on some racial violence. But the predecessor to that was you out a generation and a half out of enslavement, people who were formerly in chattel slavery, built a small town, really thoughtful about what that looks like, that into the... If you were to take what was existing in 1921, I saw a statistic, and if you look at that same amount of property in 2020, I think it's 2022, money's worth $250 million, $250 million gone just like that, right? But the part that I'm fascinated about is what was it that allowed people who generation before? So if you look at Emancipation Proclamation up until when the town was founded, I think it was like 1865 through 1905. So you're looking at maybe about 40 years, right? A generation and a half, maybe two generations. All of a sudden came out and like, we can do this. There's something in what we know about how to do this, how to create beneficial environments for each other. That it isn't capitalism as we know it now, which is parasitic, but capitalism that was beneficial, that it benefited the community that built it up. I'm interested in the thing that I'm passionate about now is what does that mean for 2024? I think that I know you're a sports guy. I'm a sports guy. You ever seen the movie Moneyball?
I have.
Yeah. You know, and for those that are listening to this, I challenge you to go out to YouTube and put Moneyball. What problem are you solving? And the scene is really cool because I actually read this part in the book, The Moneyball, and they give a little more in depth about how they built the story in the movie. But basically, they're trying to replace somebody, you know, the best pitcher they had, and they got their contract got, you know, sold out by the Yankees or bought by the Yankees, and their best hitter, they went to the Boston Red Sox, and they're like, so what do we got to do? Well, we got to find somebody to replace him. And we got to find somebody who replaces him. And what they said and what the guys, the Billy Bean character says, yeah, that's not how you win because we'll never be that. We'll never be that rich. We have to solve a different problem. And what I'm interested in now with respect to what happened in Tulsa, what's happening in our communities and not just Black communities, but communities of color communities that have been dispossessed and disenfranchised is how do we put people in scoring position? You win baseball by putting people in scoring position. They don't have to be the best hitter. They have to be the best batter. They just have to play at the right time at the right space and get on base, right? And make outs. Play fundamental baseball is how you get put people in scoring position. And if you keep hitting singles, 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 I don't need to hit 45 home runs a year. I don't need to make $100 million a year. I don't need to have the next thing. Hell, you can go right over to NASA right now. And I challenge anybody to go to NASA, go to technology.nasa.gov or software.nasa.gov. You can go and license software from NASA right now that if it's not behind the curtain because it's for government or contractor, it's open source. Use all kinds of stuff that you can just download for free.
Somebody put me onto that. Shout out to Chris Campbell. Put me onto that before.
That's my dude. You know Chris?
I know Chris.
Right? Those are my dudes, man.
He was a guest on the podcast. He put me into in touch with the technology transfer portal. And I was like, what? And I started looking at it. And yeah. That's
Wait
amazing,
till I was with him. I was with him and his brother last night.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, he and Chris. I was Chris and Paul was with them last night. Right? And so why would I want to have to build something and feel like I have to build when I can go and license?
Yeah.
Because it's already patented. So now I've leaped the patent program, right? I've leaped the patent process because it's not about building the patent. It's about creating wealth, right? Creating opportunity, tapping into something that's already built. Why would you want to do otherwise? Right? Chris is killing it. He's going to be killing it, man.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. Well, yeah. But one of the things I'll push back on that a little bit.
Okay.
Because, and I would say, I enjoy building. You know, there's something that I've never built a product for. I'm not saying that it's not good to like find a shortcut or path here and there, but like the process of building a product, I've worked in the service side for so long that I don't think I've realized I've tapped into the word joy. Like I hadn't tapped into this joy of creating something and building something and that process of discovery. So I mean, while I'm pushing back on that, not fully, I'm just saying like there's part of this is a lot of fun too.
So shout out to Chris. When I found out what he was building, because he went and found, I'm putting those together. Mm-hmm. He's building, and for those that he's building a thing that's about the size of this letter opener, maybe a little bit about that size, right? Not very big. That if you breathe on it, it'll tell you what your blood sugar levels are. Not stick it in your finger, not, you know, my dad has one of those Libras, but you breathe on it. He built the thing. He had to have the requisite knowledge, but he didn't have to capitalize. Remember, it's about putting people in scoring position. He didn't have to capitalize the technology. He went and found the technology, and for $50,000, now, I don't know how much he paid for it, because you can go from free up to 50. I'm just making that number up, but I know it's no more than 50 grand. He's now building out something that he's creating capital. He's creating opportunity. He's saving lives. My dad has diabetes. He's definitely not getting a finger stick. And that Libra is just all the time. But can you imagine breathing on your watch or on this little device or on your cell phone and it picks it up and tells you what your blood sugar is like accurately anytime you need it without having the inconvenience? And he built it, right? He built it, but he sourced technology cheaply. Yeah. He de-risked the tech.
So you just mentioned, and just go back to putting runners in, and I love this analogy and the use of a money ball here and putting people in scoring position and getting people on base. Part of this is, again, going back to what we were talking about before and the awareness and the knowledge of knowing who is good at what and where and how to connect those dots and see who's in what position or to go to the base, who's the best runner, who's... You know, like even that process of discovery, I think, is important to like who would be on what base or at what position in the field. It's all connected.
Absolutely. I just did a presentation today where I talked about when you're building a high performing team, you have in math, I'm a real quick math lesson. And this is all I remember. My wife is a math teacher. Distributed property. So you have a parenthesis, you have something on the outside. You have two things on the inside. People and process. Right people, right process. Right. You have to have both of those to have an optimal team. You don't have the right people, you have the right process, and for what we're talking about, the right product, right? And so each one of those gets multiplied, but they in and of themselves are independent, but it's when you put it all together, right? Because the equal sign is P3 or P cubed or whatever it is. Now I've got the right people, the right product, and the right process. Holy smokes. Now I'm on to something, right? Now I know what I need to be looking for. Now I know who's batting top of the order, middle of the order, and cleanup, right? Because now I'm putting people where they need to be, because my cleanup guy might be the power guy that's going to bring home the speedster who just happens to be on base, right? Got an infield single, and that's all they're going to get. And now I've loaded the base, and now I got the right guy, but I don't want my power hitter hitting first. Because now you got somebody who's going to bring the smoke. He's going to throw him a bunch of curveballs and he can't hit it, right? Can't hit it.
Well, Ty, thank you for, again, your time. Congratulations on your success. Everything you've been doing. Really, really impressed with everything. And man, that hour went fast. We're going to have to do this again.
Wow, it did. It is an hour. I appreciate you. Thank you, Dustin.
Yeah, right at the buzzer. We got it. Hey, thanks, Ty. And again, I'll have all the information in the show notes.
I'd like to take the chance to introduce our audience to Pixly. Pixly is the fastest and easiest way to document and collaborate on your projects with photos, videos, tags, tasks like punch lists, reports, and dashboards. Thousands of customers trust Pixly, from large hospitals, commercial real estate professionals, and every size contractor and field service professional. Try Pixly for free. Go to www.pixly.ai, and if you mention Dustin Sutton on your dropdown, you'll get 25% off. Again, that's www.pixly.ai, and mention Dustin Sutton. Thank you very much.